This audio is a substitute for the retrospective seminar given on September 15th, 2011, simply because I just forgot to punch the record button on the recorder that I had in my pocket. So, like many classes I've done in the past where something's gone wrong, the battery's gone out or something like that, I just redo the audio portion. It's the same slideshow presented as a PDF, and when you hear a little pause, then that probably means next slide. I'm not going to say next slide. So I'll try to convey the inflections and everything else. What you're not going to hear is the audience reaction, of course, or the introduction, or a couple of the questions at the end, but I'll try to remember what those questions are and talk about them afterwards. The title is Half Century Spent in the Company of Tiny, Dumb, and Uncooperative Animals, and I've been asked by a number of people whether those, where the title refers to either students or colleagues, and so I'd like to say a word or two about these two pictures that are up on the screen, just to assure you that that's not necessarily the case. The one on the right is a bluegill. It's a diagram of a common panfish that you find in North American ponds, and many of you have not only caught them but eaten. And what you see in this picture is really what a parasitologist sees when he or she looks at a fish. I think most people simply look at a fish and say, yeah, it's a fish. But we see all of the interactions that that species has with the parasites that live in it and live on it. And the ones on the diagram here are really just a few of the ones that you would expect if you checked out the primary literature on bluegill for any several year period of time. It includes several phyla of animals. It includes animals that live on the external surface of the fish. It includes larval stages that burrow into the muscle. It includes worms that are isolated into very specialized habitats, such as the pyloric cicae. Like I say, there are a number of different phyla involved. And you can, even though this is a bluegill, you really could substitute any of the 30 or 31,000 species of bony fish and sharks raised in skates, or any of the 5 or 6,000 species of mammals, and you could put it right in there where that fish is, or any of the 10,000 species of birds or several thousand species of amphibians and reptiles. So it's this kind of situation in which each of these species of vertebrates participates in a complex set of interactions that make parasitologists fairly well educated, fairly broadly educated, I should say. Most scientists look at the natural world and say, what makes this system operate? Well, this system, the bluegill, operates in a very complicated set of relationships, and so each of those participants has a long evolutionary history. Each of them has a set of ecological requirements of their own, and so this is why not only parasitologists are not only broadly educated, but they also tend to see interesting research problems about everywhere they look, and this is why they tend to thrive at biological field stations. On the left, over here, what you're seeing is a damselfly at the bottom and then the gut out of that damselfly up on the top. Then over at the left is the dissection of that gut. And all of those long white structures are single-celled, macroscopic. You can see them without a microscope if you look closely. Macroscopic parasites that are simply cramming the gut of this thing. You can tell by the fact that there are these spheres that are the cysts, and also the sizes, the fairly uniform sizes of these cells, that this animal has been infected for almost all its life, for about 2 weeks. And it's done that, it's lived this life in an environment characterized by a couple of species of swallows constantly eating flying insects, 5 or 6 species of larger dragonflies that feed on the damselflies, as well as a whole bunch of frogs and toads that, and other predatory insects that eat damselflies as they emerge. So it's this kind of observation that you see over and over again in nature that makes you a little suspicious of claims about parasitism being a factor that controls populations. Well, this is supposed to be a retrospective seminar, and faculty members are generally hired to teach, expected to do research and service, and during the course of their careers, they do a lot of writing. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the teaching experience, the research, a little bit of service, and hopefully toward the end, we'll have time to talk about some creative writing. What you see on the screen now is a list of the courses that I've taught in the last 45 years. When I showed up here, and the ones in white are large lecture section, 200, 250, and the numbers are the numbers of semesters taught, which are actually the number of years, because I've never, to my knowledge, taught the same course two semesters in a row. I showed up here in August of 1966, Brent Nickel, another parasitologist, and I showed up. We got very generous startup packages consisting of two sheets of paper. One of them was a form that you could fill out to apply for a grant to the Research Council to get a decent microscope, and the other form was some instructions on how to fill out the first one. Also, when the department secretary finally figured out that I was not a student, she gave me my office key and gave me my first teaching assignment, which was over in Love Library Auditorium, and there were 291 students in that class, and it met 7:30 Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday morning. That was a memorable experience, and I ended up teaching at 7:30 Tuesday, Thursday for a number of semesters, and I still interact socially with some of the people in those first classes. The course numbers with X's on them are ones that I really taught early in my career, and I simply don't remember or couldn't find the numbers. The next slide is a continuation of that. I've taught one semester of parasitology seminar every year since I've been here. History and literature of zoology was one that I taught early on, which was really a lot of fun. Centennial College was an experimental in-residence college that I spent time in two spring semesters in the early 70s. And actually, within the last few years, I've really taught an upper division graduate English class, 459, 859, called Writing About Nature. As a result of teaching that class, I ended up on a bunch of English department doctoral committees, and one of the students out of that class was a young man named Brian Densing, who is now, I believe, a pitcher for the Minnesota Twins. Brian's writing about nature involved weather, playing ball and the weather and the conditions of various fields that they played on throughout the country. I thought it was great writing. Getting grades to somewhere between 18 and 19,000 students. I've read, for those of you that may have been in any of my classes, you know we do a lot of writing, even in the large introductory classes. And so I've read about 500,000 pages of student writing over the course of my career. Next slide gives a list of the mentoring activities. So we've had 18 master students that have gone through the lab, 14 doctoral students, at least 100 undergraduate researchers. And about 15 years ago, I said to one of the graduate students in my lab, normally, you know, we take off and go drink beer on Friday afternoon. So I said to Ben Handelt, how do we engage these young women who are working in the lab, who are very bright and doing superb, in many cases, publishable work? How do we engage them in the kind of big talk that we talk about when we go down to Barry's Tavern? And he said, let's just go to coffee at 3:30 somewhere off campus, and after an hour or so, the grown-ups can go to the bar. And I said, okay, that's a great idea. Well, Friday coffee turned into a tradition in our lab, and it really it was almost like a 15-year weekly focus group in which I heard all kinds of conversation about classes, faculty members, the university. We had discussions about professionalism, ethics, science. It just went on and on and on. A lot of contact with students. Also out at Cedar Point, when you ride around in the vans and on trips to regional scientific meetings, As soon as we get in those vehicles, the students start talking. So I heard thousands of hours, really, of student conversation about the institution. And also in the late 60s, became really obvious that my better students were going to come back and ask for letters of recommendation. So I started calling in the top 20% of those large classes and interviewing them personally just to find out who they were, because I knew that a year or two later they'd be back in my office asking for a letter. And so the take-home lessons that you're about to see relative to the teaching part of my career are really based on all of this experience and all of this interaction, and I would say that it's typical of senior faculty members and it constitutes the institutional memory. One of the things you figure out right away, looking at the next slide, is that there is a lot of heterogeneity in the current student population. This has always been the case, but those items highlighted in white are ones that I believe have over the years changed fairly dramatically. The reading skills have gone down, in my view. Their attention span has dropped precipitously. And the kind of advice that they're getting either from high school or from the pre-health advisors over in Old Father Hall is not very healthy, not necessarily to every student's benefit. It's very much a consumer-driven, career-driven, rather than an intellectual-driven advice. The university is working overtime to diversify its student population, generate even more heterogeneity in not only the student population, but also the faculty population. And yet our biological sciences curriculum is pretty much carved in stone. If I had any recommendations, I would sort of loosen up the whole educational enterprise, take some lessons from the football program, go out and get your best people as early as you can, get them on the field. In our case, get them out in the field at Cedar Point and push on them and bring them into the fold. Next slide has a list of information age items that sort of make up the daily and hourly lives of not only our students, but as you can see by those asterisks, the faculty. I certainly don't use Blackboard anymore or clickers because I'm not really teaching, but all of these things, all of this electronic communication and all of this digital media and all of these toys serve together one very, very striking function, and that is they separate human beings from one another. Regardless of how much you believe that you're interconnected with the world when you get on the web, the simple truth is nowadays you walk down the campus sidewalk and see hundreds of students totally isolated with their ear, their machines plugged into their ears, or totally isolated with their smartphones and texting and so forth. And they think they're connected, but they're not really. And all of this electronic media really separates human beings from direct contact with one another. And I feel that is a very negative aspect of modern information technology, and one that the institution really needs to kind of address, or individual faculty members at least need to address. So here are the take-home lessons. Take-home lesson number one: no matter how hard you try, or how good you really believe you are, how good your colleagues think you are, somebody hates your guts. And after I made this slide, I thought, guts, huh? I've got a slide of some guts. So here's a tray of a postmortem on a gentleman from India, I believe, who has died of intestinal blockage of ascaris. I need to say that one out of every four people on Earth has one of these worms. Of course, most of them don't live in Lincoln, Nebraska, and most of them don't have quite this many. But I figure that really, no matter how hard you try, at least or about 5% of your students really are terrified of you and don't like you very much, and they'll tell you that on their evaluations. Flip side of that is, no matter how bad you are or how bad your colleagues think you are, somebody thinks you're great. And again, that figure is about 5%. third take-home lesson I think is the most important, and that is that our most valuable resources walk in our front door every August, and they walk in by the thousands. And in my view, again, we need to loosen up our curriculum, loosen up our ways of interacting, become a little more engaged with that set of resources. For example, picture over on the right, this is Marianne McDowell and Mike Fertig, who were recruited right out of the front row of Hendrick Auditorium, and recruited into Cedar Point as introductory students between their freshman and sophomore year. And they became intrigued with research. They fell in love with Western Nebraska. Mike is now an internationally renowned scholar with lots and lots and lots of external support from national institutes of health. He has studies the genetics of drug resistance and malaria. Marianne is an immunologist. They both have PhDs from Wisconsin. They're both faculty members at Notre Dame. And in this particular picture, they brought a couple of their kids back to Cedar Point, Western Nebraska, where they not only became an item, but also sort of developed their love of research and biology and got their starts. In my opinion, again, because of the lack of faculty engagement with the introductory program, and especially the lack of faculty engagement with the field program in recent years, we're missing about 5 of these kind of people every year, maybe 10. Which means that if you had that engagement in place right now, then 10 years from now, there would be 50 to 100 of these young scientists out in the academic community. And 20 years from now, which goes by in a blink, trust me, there'd be 100 to 200 of them out there sending you postdocs, sending you good graduate students, interacting with you professionally, and in general, pushing the reputation of the University of Nebraska. So that failure, in my view, one of our biggest failures of recent years, is to really exploit these resources that walk in our front door. I might talk then a little bit about my last teaching experience last spring in the core organismic biology class, BIOS 103. This figure shows you a grade distribution, and this is a class where they not only had a lab, they did really a very nice experiment on ciliate feeding that formed the basis of a scientific paper that they wrote. They each had a single specimen that was theirs for the semester, a marine mollusk shell that they did a variety of things with in lecture. They got into the primary literature on primary taxonomic literature first week of the semester. They were in that literature regularly. They did they each downloaded a mesquite, the phylogenetic software. They produced phylogenetic hypotheses on as a result of morphological data that they gathered in lab. They did a GenBank exercise in which they looked at the genetics of their chosen species. The vast majority of them got full credit on their semester portfolios. They did weekly writings. They did weekly self-assessments. This list went on and on and on and on and on of what they really accomplished. And I felt that this class came out of the experience very well educated. In this class, they had the highest letter grade distribution of any course I've ever taught in my life. 67% of them got B's or better, and about 80 of them got A's out of that 250. That's a third of the class ended up really with A or better. I think what's important about this graph is to read the text in the bottom, that bottom white box, and I'll just read that to you, even though you can read it yourself. 3 times during my 45-year career, I have felt that it was necessary to keep a student engaged in conversation until I was personally convinced that person was not self-destructive, and all 3 of those times dealt with grade stress, and all of them occurred during the last 2 weeks of the spring semester, last 2 weeks of April 2011. So even though those students are doing well, in my opinion, even though they're getting educated, even though they're very, very bright, they are under enormous stress for some reason or another. My grade, my teaching evaluations in this class were the lowest by far of any class I've ever taught at this university in the last 45 years. Of course, in the next slide you'll see that I blame it all on George Bush. What we're looking at now among first and second year students are young people who've been under the No Child Left Behind teaching philosophy for most of their, well, for half their lives, since they were about 10 years old. This is a pedagogical approach characterized by testing and punishment, and every teacher with any experience whatsoever knows that that approach is a total failure. And what we produced, in my opinion, is a generation obsessed with the correct answer and absolutely terrified of uncertainty. The scientific mindset, however, is one in which we tend to search for good questions, and we admire people who come up with the good questions, and we have this lifelong attraction to uncertainty because that's the source of our research questions and our inspiration. For those of you who don't know who this gentleman is, the former Thompson Forum speaker, if you're a student, then I encourage you to raise your hand the next time you go to class and ask your biology faculty member to give you a short discourse on this individual and his impact and why he would be selected as a Thompson speaker. Well, I think I'll go on now and talk a little bit about research. I did my doctoral work at the University of Oklahoma, and I was a research assistant for 3 years on a large project involving the intercontinental movement of birds and arthropod-borne viruses and parasites. And we had three main research sites, one in Manitoba, one along the Gulf Coast, but our regular research site was in the central in Barton County, Kansas, at a place called the Cheyenne Bottoms, right in the middle of Kansas. I spent 3 years commuting back and forth that 600-mile round trip. My thesis dealt with the natural transmission dynamics of avian malaria, bird malaria. You can see some infected cells right there in the center. Had a number of really interesting experiences during those 3 years. I never paid more than 22 cents a gallon for gasoline. Spent a lot of time driving 100 miles an hour on dirt roads. That was great fun. There are a lot of, I think that that's where I fell in love with storms. One of those days out in the middle of that 50 square miles of marsh, a hailstorm came along and simply destroyed the university station wagon that I was in, smashed out the windows and the lights, and these were chunks of hail bigger than a softball. So I drove that back to Norman and turned it into Autopool and said, here, guys. But at the end of those 3 years, it had become obvious that you couldn't really be a field biologist and a responsible husband and a father at the same time. And regardless of how responsible I might have been, I was certainly a husband and father. So I applied for and received a postdoc under the tutelage of this next gentleman, Leslie Stauber at Rutgers University. Stauber had, during the 50s and early 60s, published a number of papers in which he'd done the very basic work, animal infection, course of infection studies, on members of the genus Leishmania, and so I might talk about those just a little bit. These are flagellated protozoans, protistans. They are members of a very important, economically and medically important family, Trypanosomatidae, which you see over on the right with these two patients. One of them is infected with the visceral form of leishmaniasis. The other one has a cutaneous infection with a different species. Some of these species produce horribly disfiguring erosions of the palate and nasal septum, particularly in parts of Latin America. The flagellated forms up there in that diagram are transmitted by sandflies, members of the family Psychotidae, the subfamily Phlebotimidae. And once they're injected into the bloodstream, they get taken up by cells of the reticuloendothelial system, and they lose their flagella and become these little round bodies and proliferate. So this these infections, some of them are fatal if not treated over the course of a year or so. This family of parasites is responsible for the classical African sleeping sickness. And if you go to the blood bank and fill out the questionnaire, they'll ask you whether you've had Chagas disease, and that's another one caused by Trypanosoma cruzi, prevalent throughout much of Latin America. So these are human pathogens, and they are great fun to work with. And I was determined after that field experience to work on something that I had complete control over in the laboratory. Well, Stauber, this next slide is a graph showing really a rather iconic figure of courses of infections in various hosts injected with Leishmania donovani. And over on the right, you can see a macrophage that has a bunch of these parasites in it with the arrow pointing. This is exactly the kind of figure that needs to be developed before anyone can start designing a drug treatment program or a vaccination program or conduct immunological studies. You need to know what happens when the parasite gets inside the host, and this is a figure. Next slide shows cute little hamster. I never liked them very much. They're very bitey. They've got nasty teeth. Their urine is really unpleasant. I've never been able to figure out why people keep them as pets or if they give them to their kids as pets. But they are great hosts for members of the genus Leishmania, because as you'll see in the next slide, this is one in a terminal case with an ascites tumor buildup of fluid in the body cavity. They're great hosts for Leishmania, and they, in many ways, their infection proceeds the same way as over the course of a few weeks, in the same way that it would in a human being. These turned out to be very dangerous animals, of course. Next slide shows a dissection of a non-infected control and an infected one. You'll see that spleen is greatly enlarged and the liver is also greatly enlarged. This is exactly what happens in human beings also. Next slide, over the course then, two things happened when I got to Rutgers, and the first one was that the postdoc who was already there took me aside and said, "Hi, doc," sort of like, "Okay, rookie." And he did take me aside and showed me everything. He showed me how to do the work. He said, "Here's how to hold your dissecting instruments. Here's how to hold your glassware. Here's how to make culture medium. Here's how to hose everything down with alcohol. Make sure that the stuff is sterile. Here's how to work around a giant fire without blowing the place up. Here's how to inject animals in the heart. Here's how to take, or in the tail vein of mice. Here's how to draw blood. Here's how to do this work with these dangerous animals without getting infected." And I greatly appreciate that. His name was Bill Hansen. He went on back to the University of Georgia. But second thing that happened was that Dr. Stauber said, "John, we just bought a new Gilson respirometer and nobody knows how to use it." I said, "Well, you know, I had taken a course in comparative physiology, so I knew how to use that. It didn't take much to figure that out." And so I started a series of metabolic studies, just simple, you know, simple metabolism studies on the on what happens during transformation from the liver stage to the culture stage, which is supposedly the sandfly stage of these parasites. And then and that was started out to be pretty productive. So when I got to Nebraska, the first thing we did was go down to Christmas break, trapped some cotton rats and brought them back and sent off for cultures. And there began a 15-year study of comparative metabolism and host cell interactions with these parasites. It really was not very difficult to get outside money. We never got staggering amounts of it, but we sure were able to first, well, at least 12 out of those 15 years had support from the United States Army, because as you can tell from the animal infections, leishmaniasis is a zoonosis and military personnel get it. So we had money from the Army, from NSF, from WHO, and And that was, I will say that, that really the easiest research that I've ever done, simply because we could tell the species, we could tell the material when we were going to work on it, rather than the other way around. I think the three big papers that came out of all of that, well, we published a lot, but the big ones that came out, Mal Bhattacharya's study of molecular exchanges. This is a very creative piece of work, where he pre-labeled host cells with tritiated uridine or leucine, and then infected them with unlabeled parasites, or he did the reverse. Pre-labeled the parasites, infected unlabeled cells, and then with a combination of trichloroacetic acid precipitations and DNAs and RNAs digestions, he was able to show that the parasites made DNA out of host cell RNA turnover products. And we now know, of course, that these parasites are unable to synthesize purines and pyrimidines, and so the salvage pathways are how they what they use to build their nucleic acids. Now, the Pierre Daggett work had very strong evolutionary implications. He used a bunch of species that normally resided in insects, and began a series of manipulations to increase their infectivity to mammals, and then in the process studied their exo and the macromolecules that they released in culture. There was a lot of interest at the time in those so-called exoantigens because they were candidates for vaccine development or were perhaps useful in diagnosis, and they were also potentially at least secretions that function to communicate with the host cell and tell it what to do or not to do. And Gerald Kudish then in the late 70s and early 80s picked up on that and did a very creative set of experiments where he used a target species to show that the Leishmania donovani, which causes visceral leishmaniasis, would inhibit the in vitro macrophage digestion capacity. And I thought those were really well done pieces of work and look back on them with a certain sense of accomplishment. However, also at this time, I spent 5 years as a consultant with WHO, and each of those years spent about a month in Switzerland on and off and two or three different trips. I figured out right away that the Europeans were way ahead of us in terms of regulatory compliance, and yet my own life, professional research life, was characterized by what seemed like exponentially increasing compliance regulations, rabbit cages, animal care this, animal care that, veterinary this, veterinary that, and radioisotope inventory. It just seemed like a massive burden. And that compliance burden was increasing, and yet the infrastructure that we had for taking care of it was not increasing at all. And so at some point I said, that's enough. I'm spending too much time answering the regulators and not enough time having fun. Well, Cedar Point Biological Station opened in 1975, and as you'll see by the next slide, by that time, our family had grown up enough so that they not only wanted to go out to the field station and hang out, but they were mostly crying when it came time to come home at the end of the summer. And so one day I just simply went in the lab and poured those cultures full of alcohol and dumped them down the sink and said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to go to the field and go back and study some of these parasite systems in nature, like I really started out doing 15 or 20 years ago. As you can see by these pictures of the Platte River, two or three things became obvious right away as soon as we started going to Cedar Point. One of them is that the Plains killifish, like a number of those other species, had a rich parasite community, several different species that depended on it. But what was intriguing to me was that the South Platte River fluctuated, the stream flow fluctuated, sometimes orders of magnitude and on different time scales. The two pictures you're seeing here were taken at different times, of course, but they're taken from almost exactly the same place. And those two trees on the bottom on the left, you can see them in both photographs. So what we had was a system in which all of these evolved life cycles, like you saw on the first slide, were taking place, and in some ways sometimes coping with these order of magnitude changes in the transmission environment. And so I immediately started a series of long-term studies, and I had a number of students who did the same thing on the population dynamics of these parasites and Fungus zebrinus. This next slide is one that you some of you may have seen before, and it sort of summarizes best, I believe, kind of the fundamental observations here. The yellow line is annual average daily stream flow measured in cubic feet per second, like Department of Water Resources does. And what you'll see is that in some years, for example, in 1982-83, the South Platte River was flowing at about 2,400 cubic feet per second every day, all year long. And that's what it looks like up there at the top picture. And yet, at other times, for example, in the early 90s, the flow rate is very, very low, down to 200 or sometimes 300 cubic feet per second. The blue line represents the percent of these fish that are infected with a parasite called Posthodiplostoma minimum, which is a worm that lives, a tiny worm that lives in great blue herons, and yet spends its larval life in fish of various kinds. And what you see is that when the river goes up, then over about a two-year lag period, the prevalence of this parasite starts to drop, and as the river stays up, that prevalence drops very close to zero. Once the river starts going down again and stays down, then the prevalence rises substantially back up to essentially 100%. And what's not shown in this graph, of course, are the numbers of these worms, which get up into the several hundreds per fish. What's really happening here is that stream flow affects the snail population. And when stream flow is high, snails that are the intermediate host from which this fish gets these parasites get washed out. And when the river goes down and stays down, the snail populations build back up. Well, what controls Platte River stream flow is Rocky Mountain snowpack. So what's really running this whole system is not the immunity of the fish or the effects of the parasite on the fish or vice versa, but the amount of snow in the Rocky Mountains. And so once this became obvious to us, then we started addressing a whole series of questions with various systems and asking what events actually dictate the flow of materials, parasite tissue, into hosts. I think some of the examples of some of the more interesting papers are the first big one we published out of this, called Evolutionary Constraints on Population Structure, in which we looked at seven different parasite types and how their populations evolved, or pardon me, how their populations dealt with this Platte River stream flow. Matt Bullock probably did the most of this kind of work. He's now a faculty member at Oklahoma State University. And asking really about the constraints and the avenues, constraints upon and the avenues for transmission and the evolutionary impact of those. Jill Detweiler really addressed some of those same questions, the relationship between host specificity and host parasite encounter. But using a series of five or six species of flower beetles and their larvae, we've been doing a bunch of really elegant cross-infection experiments. Jill, by the way, is the reason we have a piano at Cedar Point Biological Station. She's another one of those that I tried to recruit out of the freshman organismic biology class simply because of her performance and her writing. And she said, no, I can't come out there for the summer because I have to practice the piano. I'm a double major, piano performance and biology. And I said, well, if we buy you a piano, can you come out? Will you come out? She said, she kind of laughed. So I went up to Mary Bannister, who was our associate director of Cedar Point at the time, and I was director of Cedar Point at the time. And I pulled $50 out of my pocket and said, here, Mary, put this in an envelope, send out an email, let's see how much money we can raise to buy Jill a piano. So we had about $500 in a week, and I called up a music store in Ogallala, and they delivered the piano, and Jill didn't have any choice but to come on out. You had to get up in the middle of the night to hear her play, however, which was rather stunning. Jill stayed and got her master's degree. This publication is her, out of her master's work. Went to Purdue for a PhD, and she's now on a postdoc at Texas A&M. Another example of what I think we're missing by not getting much more engaged as a faculty member with those students who walk in our front door, and especially with the field program. Well, you can't manipulate the Platte River like you can a hamster. And so about this time, I also bought my first computer and decided to try some modeling. And we, as a result of looking at all of these numbers and asking how they arise, then we've done a number of modeling papers, and that's continued. We have one we're working on now with Trematode Life Cycle. And the last 2 years, I've been working with David Logan and the Root students, Research for Undergraduates in Theoretical Ecology, on Brittany Bunker has been the one who spent all last summer trying to put values on model parameters. And David Logan is the one who's doing the heavy mathematical lifting in these current efforts. So this is kind of ongoing, and it's enormous fun. Take-home messages, I think, from 45 years of research were best expressed by, to me at least, by a gentleman by the name of Robert Coatney. I was at some meetings in Washington, and my major advisor took me on a tour of NIH, and Coatney was the individual who ran the human subjects anti-malarial drug testing program during World War II. Used prison inmates as volunteers, and he ran that program. So we were walking down the hall, and Coatney was sitting in his office, and Self said, J.T. Self, who was my advisor, said, how'd you like to meet Coatney? I said, God, love to meet the guy. He was one of my heroes. So I walked in and got introduced, and he said in his blustery Irish voice, so you want to be a parasitologist, you want to be a scientist, well, here's some advice. Always be finishing something, and obey the Andrew Carnegie rules, and budget about 10% of your resources just for gambling. So I said, okay, it sounds like pretty good advice. What are the Andrew Carnegie rules? And he sort of sat up in his chair and said, surround yourself with people who are smarter than you are, get out of their way and let them work, and then you go out and brag about what they did. Well, those are pretty good rules, and I think, you know, I've been able to at least do that, surround myself with people who are smarter than I am, and they really paid off. So that's the research. Let's go on now and talk a little bit about service. The next slide shows my major service experiences over the last 45 years. I was an assistant dean of arts and sciences before I was tenured. Spent 5 years as a consultant to WHO. Been director of Cedar Point Biological Station a couple of times. Interim director of the museum a couple of times. I was ASP, American Society of Parasitologists, secretary treasurer for 6 years. And that was essentially like running a small business. I had a wonderful woman, Beth Wilkins, who was my half-time assistant. And that did a lot of things, like negotiate electronic publishing contracts with Allen Press, negotiate signed venue contracts for meetings, you know, several years in advance. I think probably one of the most memorable experiences was signing a $14,000 bar tab in a Mexican hotel, which was a little bit of a shock at the time. It sort of prepared me for the $17,000 bar tab I signed in the same hotel the next night. Those things eventually got paid. The first year we were here in 1966, Karen and I went to San Juan, Puerto Rico to the American Society of Parasitologists meetings and heard the presidential address delivered by the University of Nebraska's Harold W. Manter, for whom this building, our building, is named. And as a result of this year's elections, if I stay healthy and alive for the next few years, then I'll get to deliver the presidential address in 2014 in New Orleans. And I can tell you that that's sort of a interesting, kind of an emotional situation. I started working on the speech already. Next slide show is really the same one as the science, is the research compliance slide, but this involves my experiences. Over that 10-year period in those major administrative jobs, the museum job during the middle 80s was an enormous amount of fun, and had there not been so much hostility, outright hostility, toward the museum on the part of several biological sciences faculty members, then I probably would have applied for that museum job and tried to become museum director and gone that direction with my career. But it was obvious from the way our faculty was behaving that they simply were going to torpedo any effort whatsoever to strengthen both the museum and the department by working a little more cooperatively with one another. And I never understood that, because that museum is really a truly major teaching and research resource for biological sciences. The individuals responsible for that hostility are now all gone. 10 years later, I came back again because of personnel issues over in the museum. I came back as director, interim director, and this time things were quite different. We had a state audit by the state auditor. Do you own all the specimens you say you own? We had safety audits. Safety issues in the museum are really pretty interesting. You don't often think of a museum as being a hazardous place, but you know, in our own lab, our biggest worry is making sure that we get the cap back on the used chemicals bottles before somebody shows up and takes a picture of it and reports us to the administration. But over in the museum, you find yourself wondering about such things as, what do we do with a mounted polar bear whose skin was preserved in arsenic, and the kids would dearly love to get their hands on their pet. So, and we also dealt with NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, and sent out inventories to 800 different tribes. So there was a lot of that compliance, and it was reasonably interesting and educational. The next slide and the next two slides sort of illustrate my reaction to the overall research experience. When you're a faculty member, all of your communication really comes from your teaching and from your students and your colleagues and your research, and most of it deals with biology, and most of it is interesting, and it concerns living organisms, and very often it's a great deal of fun. However, once you become an administrator, all of your communications come from above, and most of them concern money, or facilities, or regulations, or deadlines, or something of the sort. And I think that if you're a young faculty member dealing with administrators, then you kind of need to know the two situations, the difference between a faculty member and an administrator. Or if you're thinking about going into administration, then this is your fate. That's not to say it's bad or uneducational, but it happens. If I had any take-home messages from those administrative experiences, it would be I found myself constantly asking the novelist's question: Why are people behaving this way? Why do they do the things that they do? And looking back on all those experiences, I'd say that the people who pursue their dreams with love and joy and live their lives and their intellectual lives out of love and joy and make their decisions out of love and joy end up having rich and interesting lives regardless of how wealthy they may become financially. Those whose motivations are pride and money seem to always be, if not always frustrated, eventually get frustrated. Well, let me go on then and spend the last few minutes talking about creative writing. School of Biological Sciences was formed in 1973, and for the next 10 years, I think the working environment was characterized by intense internal political stress, really very damaging stress, academic politics. And I simply woke up one morning about 3 o'clock and looked up the ceiling and said, nobody in their right mind puts their whole sense of self-worth and their future and the future of their family in the hands of a Nebraska state agency. I'm going to write the great American novel and make $1 million and throw my office keys into the football stadium and drive off into the sunset. So I got up and went down to downstairs to my typewriter and started typing the Great American Novel. Well, it didn't really turn out that way, but ever since, really going back to the early 70s, I've spent an hour a day, sometimes an hour and a half, on creative writing. And you write an hour a day, that gives you a page a day, and a page a day gives you a book or two a year, and if a third of those get published, then somebody pays attention. So I think a 33% success rate is pretty good if you if you're an artist or a musical composer or a writer. But I just simply started doing it. What you see there is my recent office. Well, certainly since the early 80s, I've gotten up very, very, very early in the morning and done my class preparation at 3 and 4 in the morning and taken off in the middle of the morning, then over to the student union, just spent an hour drinking coffee and writing. Actually, I started doing this at a place called I think it was Dave's, which is where it was a coffee shop where Kimball Recital Hall is now, and that's where I wrote Yellow Legs. And it was eventually torn down, and I moved over to the Student Union, where I've written virtually every other book since. I might talk about those books in a way that I hope is sort of informative. Next slide. First of all, that book list includes things that you might expect a biologist to write, including textbooks. Gerald Schmidt and Larry Roberts were the authors of the first four editions of Foundations of Parasitology. Gerald Schmidt died young, and Larry called me and said, I need a co-author. Would you consider becoming that co-author? So I started with the fifth edition of Foundations, and we're now working on the ninth. We just started the ninth. You'd expect a biologist to write about essays about travels, and On Becoming a Biologist is one of the more interesting books. That was one that was negotiated by my literary agent, and the editor on that at Harper & Row was Rick Cott, who was a truly superb editor. I guess one of the take-home lessons from writing books is that when you have a good editor, they make you look like $1 million, and when you don't have a good editor, they let you get by with both your best and your worst. And so all of those things have happened to me. More examples of what you'd expect a biologist to write. Teaching in Eden was originally entitled Exporting Camelot, and the editors at Routledge said that sounds too much like too Kennedy-esque, and so we need another title. And so it came out Teaching in Eden. This is all of the pedagogy written as really essays, but all of the pedagogy from Cedar Point that I've tried to apply to the large classes here on city campus and the smaller ones. Outwitting College Professors was supposed to be part of the Pearson College Success Package, and I eventually got those publishing rights back, and the third edition is now out and available either in paperback or as an ebook. When you're a writer, you also do a lot of reading, and I'll go to Barnes & Noble and look through there and think, you know, I could write a book like this. The Ginkgo is one that I worked on for about 20 years, and I thought I'd just give you some quotes from people who've reacted to it in various ways. My literary agent declined to handle it, and she said, this is an evocative book about ideas, exactly the kind of thing the American bookbinding public is getting increasingly impatient with. So I thought, a nation that's getting increasingly impatient with these kind of books is not in very good shape, and getting worse. So, and I rewrote the prologue and used that quote in it. The Ginkgo is really about a student who comes to the university from Western Nebraska and writes some papers about a single ginkgo tree, and the last one is a long frame tale about the death of her tree 1,000 years hence and what the world has become 1,000 years hence. Incidentally, if nothing happens to the University of Nebraska, then those ginkgo trees planted right out there outside this building will still be here 1,000 years from now. And so this, I think, is a piece of literary fiction. Also, Tuskers, I was at a party one night, and a friend of mine said, I'd like to go out to Western Nebraska with you sometime when you go collecting. I said, sure, I'm going tomorrow morning at 3 in the morning. And so he said, well, I'll go along. So I picked him up at 3 in the morning, we drove to Roscoe and collected fundulas, and then drove back to Lincoln the same day. But during this whole conversation, during this whole trip, we were talking about literature and writing. And so I was complaining that all of my efforts were not being very successful. He said, why don't you write a book about Nebraska football? Everybody will buy that. So I thought, okay, I'll write a book about Nebraska football. So Tuskers takes place on the day of the OU-Nebraska game in the year 2090. It's a piece of science fiction in which woolly mammoths have been resurrected as a team mascot. And my literary agent really tried on this one. She went through 28 different rejections. And for someone who has an office in downtown New York City, this is pretty patient. So she tried and tried and tried, and I really appreciated that. Our daughter Jenna, who is now the enterprise editor for ESPN.com, of course, she's been the biggest pusher on Tusker. Dad, just publish it, just publish it, just publish it. So I finally did. The attorney who handled our estate and will retired and turned our business over to another individual. And when he was reviewing our assets, I mentioned book contracts, and he sort of jumped on that. And as a result of that, and as a result of the ease with which you can now publish an ebook or do it print on demand, I decided I needed to go back and take all those manuscripts that were pretty complete and I felt were publishable and nail down the copyrights and register the copyrights and put ISBN numbers on them and get them out there formally just to nail down my intellectual property rights on those. So that's one of the reasons this stuff ends up. Keith County Journal, that first book that really started that writing career, was rejected 22 times. My favorite rejection letter says, why do you waste your postage sending us things that don't turn us on? Well, when it was finally picked up by St. Martin's Press, the editor called and said, now we don't want to get into a bidding war with this one. I didn't tell him it had been rejected 22 times, but I said, no, send me the contract, I'll take a look at it. And so that's really how that writing career kind of got off the ground. Not long after it was published, Time Magazine called and said, we're going to review this book. Do you have a picture? And I said, sure, where can I send it? And the lady said, no need to send it. Just put it somewhere where we can find it. And so I put it in an envelope. My office at the time was 414 Matter. I just put it in, I had a picture and I put it in an envelope and wrote Time Magazine on it and put it on the floor outside my door, leaning up against the wall. And next morning when I came back, that picture was gone. And the next time I saw it, it was in Time Magazine. That probably wouldn't happen today. You'd have to send it to them electronically, but this was 1978. I've also done some film writing. The Keith County Journal and Back in Keith County were both converted into an NET movie. Chris Lejak was the cinematographer, and Michael Farrell was the producer. And this involved, well, Karen and I were lying on the beach one day, and McConaughey and Mike Farrell walked up and said, "We'd like to do a film of Keith County Journal." I said, "Fine." And so there ensued a year of me writing script. And during the summer of 1984 was when filming took place. This was 26 days of filming, and a day of 6 in the morning till 11 at night, and then a year of editing. And then that film was shown repeatedly over the next 2 or 3 years internationally and won a Corporation for Public Broadcasting Award. You come out of that, and yes, as you look at those pictures, that is a helicopter sitting right outside the kitchen door of Cedar Point. Flown by a Vietnam veteran, incidentally. When you're involved in film, you come away with a great respect for actors that maybe you didn't appreciate before. And you end up, and once you've worked on a film, then you, every time you go to the movie afterwards, you sit there and watch all of the credits. Excuse me. I was also involved in a film project on Yellowlegs, a real Hollywood film project. And that one went on for the better part of a couple of years, writing script, and it even went into production with some filming up in Canada, but eventually came to an end as a result of some events in California. And as a result of those events, there was an out-of-court settlement, and a check was deposited in the University of Nebraska Foundation, and that supported my research for a little while. I think that one of the lessons, you know, after that engagement with Hollywood and the attorneys, I thought, you know, maybe I should try the bar exam. But still, I still find the legal aspects of the entertainment and arts industry to be terribly fascinating. And again, you sit through the credits. Well, the next couple of slides are really the books that have been written over and sitting at the Student Union, or in the case of Yellowlegs, at Dave's Coffee Shop. They range from, well, here they are, Dunwoody Pond, Vermilion Sea, Fields of Friendly Strife. Comes the Millennium was written under a pen name. Jack Blake was a character in another piece of detective stuff that I was trying, and so I thought, well, I'll try that. I think probably as a summary of all his writing experiences, this book, Pieces of the Plains, and this is the cover of that, really talks about where naturalists come from, what it's like being a scientist, a biologist for 45 years at UNL. And as a result of that, that experience, what do you really see in the future of your nation? This is a book that was, we have some friends who are very, very generous supporters of the university, Rhonda and Jim Seacrest, and Jim took me to lunch one day and said, "John, I'll underwrite the publication of any book you want to write." So I said, "Okay, I'll do that. I'll give that a try." And once I started, this is the book that emerged from that. That's cover picture is Nevin's Well Tank, which is one of our major teaching and research sites out of Cedar Point, north of Paxton. And this is one that's available, I think, even through Barnes & Noble. Well, I think the take-home from that creative writing activity is do something original, do something creative, do something on your own. Your own time is the most valuable thing you have. Give some of it to yourself every day instead of giving all of it to the system. So with that, that's really about the end of my formal comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions. There was polite applause. At the end of that, there were a couple of questions about the most interesting or challenging parts of the Cedar Point experience. And I answered that with a couple of tales from when the hydroelectric plant was built and when I got a fairly formal reprimand. When the hydro plant was being built, there were some legal issues between Nebraska Public Power District and Central Nebraska Public Power and Irrigation District over something. I don't remember what they were, but those went on for a while, and once they got settled, then I knew bids would be let for that hydro plant, and I knew from the discussion in the newspaper it would involve some destruction of habitat there in Lake Keystone. And so in February, once those bids were let, in February I wrote Central and asked them for a construction map. Hello?
Yep.